Lecture 5, Interest Rates and the Demand Side of the Capital Market.
With this lecture, we move to the third of our three markets. We worked our way through goods markets and how supply and demand interacted in that market, in those markets. Then we worked to labor markets and how supply and demand interacted in those markets. This lecture and the next lecture, we're going to talk about capital markets and how supply and demand interact there. Capital markets are different. They seem different to a lot of people. After all, with both goods and labor, we're thinking about many, many different kinds of markets. In the old Soviet planning system, when they were trying to plan goods and so on and have the government dictate what would be produced and how it would be produced, they had 20 million goods listed they were trying to organize the production of. If you looked in the U.S. economy, my guess is that by the time you look at all the varieties and sizes and shapes and everything, you have many, many more than 20 million goods out there. You can't, and in labor markets similarly, you've got a whole bunch of goods, but for different kinds of labor, different kinds of skill, different kinds of background. The market for doctors is not like the market for construction workers or the market for bricklayers, the market for computer programmers. But capital somehow seems more homogeneous than these. Capital is, after all money one way or another. And so unlike goods, which are all separate, or labor, which is all separate, capital seems to sort of be blended more closely. Let's sort of think about that insight and hold on to it as we move on. A second reason capital markets seem different to many people, I think, is that in the Western ethical tradition, we actually have a fairly strong bias against even the existence of capital markets. In the Middle Ages, among Christians, usury, that is, the lending of money, was regarded as a mortal sin. Not just as a little bit good or a little bit bad, but as a sin that put your soul in peril. And of course, the reason that Jews became moneylenders through a lot of the Middle Ages was they were not bound by the Christian stricture against lending money. More recently, and at a less elevated level, I remember seeing a letter to Ann Landers, the advice columnist, a few years back, where someone wrote into Ann and said, "I've just loaned my kids a lot of money. Is it right that I should charge them interest?" And Anne wrote back in typical Anne style, knowing the answer to everything, and said, "I don't think a good parent would ever charge interest to kids." Interesting response. Charging interest being bad. You can imagine that if someone had written into Anne and said, "I just gave my kids a car. Could I charge them for it?" I don't think Anne would have had a huge problem with that. But charging them interest on a loan, she clearly did have a problem with. Well, this being Ann Landers, then many, many people wrote in and said, "What do you mean I can't charge interest? You know, what do you mean? Here are my kids. I've lent them tens of thousands of dollars. This is money I could have invested. I could be earning money on myself. I'm taking a risk they won't pay me back. This is the money I need for my retirement. What do you mean I can't charge them interest? What do you mean a good parent doesn't charge interest?" And being Ann, of course, she folded like wet newspaper when confronted with opposition and said, "Well, I guess charging interest is okay." But it's interesting to me that there was even an argument about it, that somehow the idea of being involved in a capital market with one's family was somehow distasteful or unpleasant. And there are any number of quotations going through the Middle Ages and through our tradition which threaten us or warn us about being involved in capital markets. Perhaps the most famous is from the play Hamlet, when Laertes receives the advice from Polonius, "Neither a borrower nor a lender be, for the loan oft loses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry." Man, neither a borrower nor a lender be. I mean, can you imagine anyone saying, "Neither a buyer nor a seller be"? You know, "Neither a worker nor an employer be." There's no similar threat or warning against being involved in goods markets or labor markets. But in capital markets, there's just this edge that somehow makes us uncomfortable about our involvement in them. To just slightly confuse matters even more, I think that our concern about capital markets, and this is somewhat true in the ethical tradition as well, is that capital markets happen on two different levels. We can confuse them often, both verbally and in terms of how we think. I sometimes describe this as saying there are two different ways to think of the word investment. One way of thinking about investment is purely in financial terms. We think about money being put away to earn interest or earn more money. And one of the reasons that usury was thought of as a sin was that somehow having money, earning money, was thought of as distasteful and wrong. On the other hand, we think of investment as a business investing money in plant and equipment, or perhaps a person investing money in their education. And so an investment in physical capital, in new building, in new plants, in new education. And that sort of investment, I think to most of us, seems very prudent and very sensible. Now that's a good thing that we ought to encourage. But of course, in the real world, in the world we live in, this financial investment and this real investment in capital or in education are really just two sides of the same coin. When you invest money in a company, then the company uses that money to buy equipment. Really, financial investment and real investment are working hand in hand. Or if you put money in a bank, you invest the money there financially, but the bank makes student loans to people, then financial investment and real investment are working hand in hand. So when we think about investment, I think that it's important to bear in mind that we're dealing with something here which to a lot of us, particularly when we talk about just the financial side and money making money, for many of us sends a little bit of a shiver down our spine. Like there's something not quite right about this. To economists, however, when you put on your economist hat, I want you to take those shivers and resolutely banish them. I want you to set them aside and not worry about them anymore. We just want to think about capital markets in the way we thought about labor markets and the way we thought about goods markets. We just want to think about them as supply and demand. And supply and demand is what they are. Supply and demand is what determines their price. Supply and demand is what makes them move. And let's take those value judgments and those question of should we ever charge interest and just kind of put it away somewhere and not think about it. Now, how can we do that exactly? Well, the easiest way to start, I think, is to think about supply and demand and think about who's on what side of each market. On the supply side of the market, presumably the supply of capital comes from savers. And savers are going to be people who put money aside in banks or in companies or in other ways. We would in general think that as we think about the supply of capital, that as the price of capital, that is the interest rate, goes up and up and up, that savers would be more attracted to saving more money. And that higher return is going to attract money. Now, it's useful to say here, although I slid over this point a little bit in lecture number 2, that when we think about suppliers of capital, it's common to think about them as being households, but it's also perfectly reasonable to think about them as being businesses. After all, there are a lot of businesses that have cash and invested in one way or another or put it aside in different kinds of accounts. And we don't want to just think about savers in terms of households and your own little bank account. We also want to be thinking about pension funds and indirect forms of saving like that, or the big surpluses that are built up in the Social Security Trust Fund. I mean, all of those are forms of saving and supply of capital where money is flowing into the market in one way or another. So when we think about supply of capital, let's think about it in that broad way. Now, what about demand for capital? Well, on the other side of the market, demand for capital presumably comes from borrowers. And we would think in general that as the price goes up, as the price of anything goes up, the demand for it, the quantity demanded, is going to drop off to some extent. So as the interest rate gets higher and higher, then folks will be more reluctant to borrow money, more reluctant to demand capital. I guess, you know, this is something that should make sense on a lot of levels. If you're thinking about buying a house and the interest rate is higher and higher, well, you might put off that purchase for a while. That is to say, you're discouraged from borrowing and demanding capital. Similarly, if you're a business and you're thinking about building a new plant or a new factory, well, if the interest rate's really high, you might put that off for a time or postpone it altogether because you're not sure you can justify paying back that amount of interest. Well, once again, if we think about supply and demand for capital coming together in the market, you can just sort of think about the same sort of framework we've been trotting out all along. At a very low interest rate, you would think, well, there's going to be a large quantity of capital demanded. People are going to want to borrow a lot if the interest rate is low, but it may not be so attractive for people to be supplying capital if the interest rate is low. And as the interest rate gets higher and higher, what we expect to happen is that the demand for capital drops off. The higher interest rate discourages people from borrowing. And as it drops off and drops off, on the other hand, as the interest rate goes up, the supply of capital rises and goes up and up. And at some point, those two come together. The quantity of capital demanded and the quantity of capital supplied match each other. We have equilibrium, we have an efficient market, we have all those sorts of words we've talked about before. It would be useful probably to take a moment here and just spell out a little bit what we mean when we say the interest rate. Because a common question that people come up with is, well, you're saying the interest rate goes up, the interest rate goes down, but in the world I live in, there are a lot of different interest rates. I mean, there's the interest rate I get paid for my bank deposits, which is a pitifully low, 2 or 3%. Now, there's the interest rate that gets paid on treasury bonds. There's the interest rate that gets paid on other kinds of government bonds. There's the interest rate I pay on my mortgage. There's the interest rate I pay on my credit card. There's the interest rate I get if I have a certificate of deposit. Deposit at a bank. These are all different interest rates. So when you say the interest rate goes up or down, what are you really saying? That's a good question, and it's one that's worth unpacking a little bit. But I would point out that it's not fundamentally a different way of talking than we were talking about before. When I said, the price of a good went up or down, we were talking about the price of some particular good. When we talk about, the price of labor going up and down, we're talking about different kinds of labor. Unskilled labor, skilled labor, wages for different kinds of workers. When we talk about interest rates going up or down, we have a variety of different kinds of investments out there, and there are a variety of different kinds of returns attached to them. So, it's not a fundamentally different kind of language. I think it just sounds a little different in the capital market than in the others. Whenever you think about an interest rate, it's useful to think about it as being broken up into three main components. And the three components are, well, the first one is just compensation for inflation. If you think about it for a moment, if you were to put money into an account that was promising you, say, a 6% return, but the inflation rate is 2%, then at the end of the year, you've only actually gained 4% in buying power. The dollar value is up 6%, but you lost 2 of that 6% to inflation. So only 4% is the actual real gain. Now, the terminology there, which is useful to remember, is that the actual interest rate which is charged is called the nominal rate, the named rate. The actual interest rate you receive in terms of buying power is referred to as the real rate. A few years back, when Mexico's economic problems were even worse than they have been recently, I remember driving into Mexico with some friends for a day, and as you crossed the border, there were enormous signs up which said, interest rate, 85%. And you thought, wow, 85% interest, how fabulous. And of course, what you had to remember was that at that time, the inflation rate in Mexico was probably about 90%. So your nominal rate of interest would have been 85%. They would have paid you the 85%. But when you subtracted off the 90% inflation rate, you actually would have been down 5% at the end of the year. And you would have been better off investing your money in something with a much lower nominal rate and also a positive real rate. So whenever you look at an interest rate, one of the first things you want to do in your mind is subtract out the amount which is inflation. And you want to subtract it out whether you are a borrower or a lender. I mean, if you're thinking about what you pay, you want to say to yourself, okay, I know that's what they're naming, that I have to pay 7%, but really, if I subtract 2% inflation, it's 5%. And similarly, if you're investing money, you say, well, yeah, they promised to pay me 6%, but I subtract off the 2% inflation, it's 4%. Think in real terms, not in nominal ones. It saves a lot of time and energy in the long run. A second part of any interest rate is that part of the interest rate is compensation for a certain kind of risk that you're taking. Now, things which tend to be riskier pay higher interest rates. For example, if you were to invest money with the U.S. government, they pay you quite a low interest rate. The reason for that is you know the U.S. government is going to repay the money. There's just no doubt they're going to repay the money. They can print the money to repay the money, so there's no reason that they won't. As a result, the risk that you get, the amount that you're compensated for risk, the risk premium, as economists sometimes say, is very low or zero. On the other hand, if you were to invest money in some really shaky company that might go up, might go down, might collapse, who knows, they might promise you, 15, 20% interest. Well, that's a high number. But you have to assume that a large chunk of what you're getting paid is compensation for taking a pretty big risk. And that you don't know for sure whether that risk works out. If the company goes broke, you might end up with nothing at all. So a second thing to think about when you look at an interest rate, first subtract out the inflation rate so you've got a real rate. Then the second thing is think about how much of that interest rate is compensation for risk on one side or another. And of course, we have compensation for risk when we pay interest rates too. If you go down to the bank and you borrow money for a car, you'll find that the rate is somewhat higher than if you borrow money for a house. Why is that? What sense does that make? The answer, of course, is that if you think of it from the bank's point of view, if they loaned money on a house and you don't pay, they know where the house is. They can get that house and they can take it from you and sell it. But if they lend you money on a car and you drive away to another state, it's a lot harder to find you and a lot more costly, and the risk to that loan is comparably higher to them. So when you think about risks, what you're paying, what you're getting, you always want to try and hold those ideas of risk in your mind. The third idea about interest rates, though, is the most interesting one and perhaps the most difficult one to gather conceptually. And that is that interest rates are partly just compensation for what economists call the time value of money. And the time value of money is something I need to spend a little time trying to explain and sort out with you. The fundamental notion here that I want to struggle with is that money now is worth more than money in the future. Now, put that way, that doesn't sound, I guess, tremendously complicated. But it's actually an idea with some sort of deep implications. Let me try and illustrate it by thinking it through in this way. Which do you prefer? In one case, one person says to you, okay, I owe you $500, I'll pay you the money right now. In another case, the person says, I owe you $500, and I'll pay you the money in 2 years. Which one of those is a more attractive option for you, and why? Well, think about that for a second. It doesn't take much thought. Certainly, it's better to have the money now. But why is it better to have the money now? Well, one possible answer is this risk idea. Maybe there's a risk they won't pay you in 2 years. They'll leave. They won't be around. So let's change the example a little. One is I'll pay you $500 right now. The other is I'll put $500 in a bank account, and it will be sitting there and waiting for you. And so I guarantee that it will be there in the bank account in 2 years. So there's no risk difference. Now, even if there was no risk difference, you would say, I'd rather have the money now. Why is that? Well, a second answer would be because of inflation. You know, inflation's going to eat up the value of the money over time. So I'd rather have the money now than wait for it 2 years. Well, let's take inflation out of the equation. Let's say they say, I'll pay you $500 plus whatever inflation is. I would say you would still want to have the money now. And ultimately, why do you want to have the money now? It's because you can use the money. I mean, there's a value to having money now, which is you can use it. You can do stuff with it. You could buy a house or go to college. You can do that sooner than you otherwise could. And so when you supply capital, when you provide capital into the labor market, what you're really doing is you're saying, I'm not going to use this money now. I'm giving up this money for the present. And because I'm giving up this money for the present, I'm not consuming it now, I'm not taking advantage of it now, I'm not using it for something, I deserve to be compensated for postponing my use, for putting it off. When you borrow money, on the other hand, what you're saying to yourself is, I want to use money now. I don't want to wait for the future. I want to use money now. In fact, I want to use money that isn't even mine. I want to use your money right now. And because I'm using your money, maybe the bank's money or a friend's money or a parent's money that you borrow from, because I'm using your money right now, I get compensated for that. I have to pay for that. I have to pay for that privilege of using someone else's money. One way I think about this sometimes, which makes more sense to some people, is that when you borrow money, what you're really doing is renting money. Just like when you rent a car or something like that, you pay and then you give back the car at the end. When you borrow money, what you're really doing is you're renting money. You use the money for a while, you pay for renting it, and then you give it back at the end. And so money has a time value. It has a value which is, it's nice to have it available now. And if you want to use it now, then you pay interest for that privilege. If you're willing to give it up now, then you're willing to receive interest because you're willing to give out that money for the present. Now, let's say that we follow this so far, or at least you are willing to go this far with me, that a dollar in the present is better than a dollar in the future. It's worth more to you if you get it in the present than in the future. Okay, how much more? How much more is it worth? And the answer economists have given to that, and financial people and business people and people who've spent some time thinking about that, is that the amount extra that it's worth depends on the interest rate which is available to you. Think about it this way. If I were to say to you, okay, I know that $100 a year from now is not the same as $100 now. I know $100 a year from now is worth, or $100 now is worth more, and $100 a year from now is worth less, but how much less? Let's say the interest rate is 10%, just to choose a kind of simple example. Then, I would say that if the interest rate is 10%, and I know the interest rate is 10%, then getting $90, and as it works out, 91 cents today, is the same as getting $100 a year from now. Now, why is that? It's because if I got the $90 and 91 cents right now, and I invested it at the 10% interest rate, in a year it will be exactly $100. So, in effect, the interest rate which is available to me determines how much less a dollar is worth in the future than it is in the present. And, of course, this can be carried off into the future. If I said, what is $100, I owe you $100 2 years from now, how much money would you take now, today, to call it even and settle that deal? Well, you could reason out, all right, let's see. Interest rate's 10%, if it is 10%. And as it works out, if I get $82.64 today, after 1 year, the interest will get me up to $90.91, and after 2 years, the interest rate will get me up to $100 exactly. And therefore, $100 2 years in the future is exactly the same value as $82.64 is to me today. Now, that process of taking a future value and saying, what is it worth to me today, is referred to as present discounted value. Takes the future and discounts it and figures out what would the future be worth in the present. And there's actually a formula or an equation for present discounted value, which appears in the booklets that came with this lecture. The formula is that the present discounted value is going to be equal to the future value divided by 1 plus the interest rate raised to the power of t, where t is the number of years that you're waiting. And you can work out that formula in a variety of different contexts. Now, in any case, when you look at that formula, the easiest way to think about it, though, is just that the present value is always the amount that if you got it now and you invested it at the interest rate that you can get year after year after year after year after year, then when you got up to that future value, that's the amount you would have. And so, conceptually, it's not a real difficult thing to lay your hands on. It's just that when you start putting in the algebra, it looks a little more complicated than it is. Present discounted value is an extraordinarily important tool. I tell students in my introductory classes that it's probably the single most practical tool they will learn in the course, bar none. I don't think anything else is even particularly close. Because so many problems in the real world, both private problems and public problems, involve thinking about things that have costs or payoffs in the future and thinking about, are they worth doing now? In order to think about anything like that, you always have to use this term of present discounted value. For example, think about a business. The business has a deal. The deal is they can make an investment that costs them $1 million right now. But they think this investment will pay off by giving them $2 million 5 years from now. Well, is that a good deal or not? Should they do it or not? If you don't know anything about present discounted value, you tend to say something like, well, invest $1 million, get $2 million. It's a good deal. Do it. But that would be way too simple, and it would be flatly wrong, because you're comparing $1 million right now that you have in your hand to $2 million, which is 5 years off in the future. And the present dollars do not have the same value as the future dollars. The present dollars are worth more. So what you would need to do is take that $2 million and say, how much is $2 million actually worth to me right now in present discounted value? Well, let's think about the interest rate. Let's work backwards and say, how much money would I take right now, present value, to be worth $2 million in 5 years? That interest rate will take into account the risk that's involved. The interest rate will take into account the time value of money. It will take into account the expected inflation over time. And you can easily find, for certain kinds of interest rates, as the interest rate gets higher and higher, that actually is a terrible deal. And what the company really ought to do is take the $1 million and stick it in this interest rate that it can get and just let the money accumulate, rather than taking the risk of going for this investment that's off in the future. In fact, the real difference in thinking here, the difference which is important to keep in mind, is a difference between what we might call an accounting point of view and an economic point of view. In an accounting point of view, if you have a $2 million return and you spent $1 million, that's $1 million in profit. I mean, unsophisticated view, but there it is. You spent $1 million, you got $2 million, you made $1 million. But the economic view would say you have to take your opportunity cost into account. If you invested that $1 million and tied it up for those 5 years, you gave up the interest you could have been earning every year along the way. And if you gave up the interest you were earning every year along the way, you better take that opportunity cost into account too. And once you've taken that cost into account by doing present discounted value calculation, the deal may not be nearly as good as you think it is. So in terms of business decisions, any business which makes long-term investments lives with present discounted value calculations all the time. I mean, it's almost what they do. It eats up their lives. But it's not just business decisions. You also have to think about things like human capital decisions, decisions about investment and so on. For example, my wife a few years back got a master's in business administration degree. Well, in thinking about an MBA and is it worth it or not, one of the things you have to think about is, okay, what's the real cost of this? Well, the real cost, of course, is the tuition. That's one cost. Then there's the opportunity cost. She had to give up her job to go to school full time. So there's the cost of her lost wages for the several years she's there. And then the benefits end up being 3, 4, 5, 6 years in the future. The extra pay she can get after she gets out. But those benefits are not the same as the cost because they're in future dollars, not present dollars. And if you're going to think about those benefits sensibly, you have to think about them in terms of present discounted value. So you can compare them to the costs which you have to spend right now. Now, this degree was a very good idea, I mean, economically as well as otherwise, and I'm not saying that it didn't make sense or anything like that. I am saying that just comparing the future to the present without making some careful judgments about present discounted value can be a very slippery and difficult business. One of the most vivid examples to me of this whole problem comes up when we talk about lottery payouts. There are an awful lot of lotteries where the really, really big prize, the really, really big multi-million dollar prizes, are not paid out in one lump sum. They're paid out over a long period of time, like a certain amount every year for 20 years or sometimes even 25 or 30 years. Now, when they announce the value of the prize, say the prize pays $1 million a year for 20 years, they say, well, that's a $20 million prize. You've won $20 million. It's $1 million a year for 20 years. But the economist would say, no, it's not. 20 million means 20 million in my hand right now. Present value, 20 million. Put it in my hand. But money which is being received 10 years in the future, 15 years in the future, 20 years in the future, that is not present value. That's money way off in the distant future. And you would have to say to yourself, how much would I actually take today at the prevailing rate of interest for $1 million 20 years off in the future? And in fact, when you do the present discounted value calculation and you work out how much you would get paid, what you typically find is that, first of all, for a big lottery prize, about a third of the money goes to taxes, and you find that another third of the announced value is actually an illusion, because it's not using present discounted value, it's using adding up future dollars as if they were present dollars. Now, the point where this degenerates into farce, I think, I mean, a lot of people sort of say, well, that's interesting, but if I won $20 million, I'm not going to bite the hand that feeds me. I'll be perfectly happy with that amount, and that's a fair comment. But clearly, it matters to the company which is running the lottery. They want to make the prize look as big as they can, because the bigger they make the prize, the more people are going to be wanting to play the game and buy tickets. And so by spreading out the prize over 20 years, they inflate its size and make it look bigger than it actually is. There was a funny situation a few years back in New Jersey where a group of elderly folks came before the state legislature, and these were people who you meet from time to time. They were all convinced they were just about to win the lottery. They knew they had it figured out. They knew the next week, the week after at the latest, the lottery was theirs. But what was really bugging them was that although they knew they were going to win the lottery, they were really annoyed by the thought that it was going to take 20 years to pay off. Because, after all, a lot of these people were 65 or older, and they said, hey, that's not fair. I want my money now. I'm 65. I don't want to be getting it when I'm 85 or 90. So the difficult part of this was that they said, well, you know, we'd like a rule. And the rule would be, if anyone over 65 wins the lottery, they get all the money up front. Now, the problem the state faced here was that, of course, the state doesn't have the money. The state didn't have, in the example I was giving, $20 million. It had about $12 million. And it was investing that money and earning interest on it and paying out the interest over time so that over 20 years it added up to a total of $20 million. But they didn't have the $20 million up front. Now, of course, you don't want to explain that very carefully because then people would be really grumpy with you for overstating the value of the lottery. So it was sort of fun to watch the state officials twist slowly in the wind as they tried to explain this. But in some states, for example, now in Minnesota, you have an option when you buy a ticket. And the option is, do you want the money up front? A smaller amount up front, or do you want a bigger amount spread out over time? And you actually make that choice when you buy your lottery ticket. But the reason it's a smaller amount up front is it's present discounted value. It's all present value if you get it up front. If it's spread out over time, it's not present value anymore. A final example where all this comes up over and over is in social policy. Many, many social decisions involve making some sort of an investment now and then thinking about what are the consequences going to be off in the future. For example, think about some environmental issue like the greenhouse effect. Now, again, I want to stay away from the whole scientific argument about whether this is true or not. Let's just say that it is a real problem for the sake of argument. The difficulty, of course, then becomes we need to spend money now in terms of additional pollution control equipment or different things like that in order to avoid something where the costs might be 80 or 100 years off in the future. Now, if you think about that problem, think about making that kind of an investment, it would be wrong to say, well, if we spend $1 million now, then we save $1.5 million 100 years from now, it's worth doing. That $1.5 million 100 years from now has to be discounted back to the present. You have to compare the cost to the benefits in present dollars. And that problem comes up when you think about Head Start programs for children where the payoff is years in the future. It comes up when you think about any kind of a program where you say the payoff is years in the future. So I do think present discounted value is just one of those fundamental tools of economics where when you think about time, and you think about amounts at different periods of time, you want to make sure you remember that what's off in the future is on a different scale than costs or benefits which are incurred in the present. Now, with that thought in mind, with the time value of money in mind, what I want to focus on now is the demand side of capital. The demand side of capital markets, and particularly firms demanding capital. The next lecture will focus really on the supply side of capital, meaning how you invest capital and how you put money aside. When firms demand capital for investment, how do they get that capital? Where does the money come from? Well, there are really three different sources for where they can get it. One source, and perhaps the most obvious one, is what's called retained earnings by economists and profit by just about everyone else. When you think about the word retained earnings, money you earned and then kept, that's just called profit in most people's book. For established companies, most of their investment capital, at least in good years when they're earning money, comes from retained earnings and profit. And again, you can sort of think in that case of the company as both the supply and the demand side of the market. It supplies the capital, it earns profits, and then it thinks, okay, what should we do with those profits? Well, we could invest them in a bank, we could invest them in some financial instrument, or we could invest it in building plant and equipment for ourselves. And the company has to think about that range of possibilities. And if it thinks that it's got good options within the company, options which will pay more than the alternative kinds of investment, then it should go ahead and spend the money on investing in its own equipment. So in that case, firms are both supplying capital and then they're using the capital that they supplied. A second way in which firms can get capital when they demand capital is by borrowing. And there are really two different kinds of borrowing that firms use that are worth a few moments of our time. One form of borrowing is issuing bonds. And I found over time that some people are a little tense about what the idea of a bond is exactly. But, it's really not a very tense thing to think about. A bond is just a way of borrowing money. And the person who's issuing the bond, like a corporation, says, I'm going to borrow money from you, and I'll pay you interest over time. And over the time that the bond is up, and it might be a 10-year bond or a 20-year bond, at the end of that time period, we'll pay you back the money we borrowed. So it's just a way of borrowing money. When you hear references to U.S. Treasury bonds, that's the government's way of borrowing money. And all the U.S. government is saying is, I'm going to borrow money from you, I'll pay you interest over time, and then at the end of the bond, if it's a 15-year bond or a 30-year bond, I'll pay you back the money that we borrowed from you. So it's just a way to borrow. There's nothing more than that, and no reason to be intimidated by what is a bond. Businesses can issue bonds and collect money in that way. The nice thing about a bond, from a business point of view, is that they promise to pay a certain interest level, but if the business does really, really well, they don't have to pay any more than that. So if you could borrow money, and you could borrow money and say, pay 6% interest, but then you earn profits of, 20% or something like that, you still just pay that 6% interest. And the rest of the money you get to keep as profit, or use as retained earnings, you can pay to your investors or invest yourself in some other way. The interest rate for bonds is going to vary a lot depending on which company is doing the borrowing. If you've got some really solid company that's making a lot of money, say Microsoft or some company like that, I don't know if Microsoft actually has any bonds, then you're pretty sure Microsoft is not going to go away tomorrow. I mean, they may have their difficulties, but they're not going to go away. They're not going to go bankrupt tomorrow. And so when they are borrowing, they can borrow at a pretty low rate. They don't have to pay very much of a risk premium on the interest rate they pay. On the other hand, if you're some tiny little company, some little biotech firm that's got three inventions and you're hoping one of them will make you some money, and you go out there and you issue bonds, you're going to have to pay a lot of money because there's a fairly good chance that none of your ideas is going to work out and you may end up broke. When you have a company which borrows and it has to pay a high interest rate because it has high risk, that's what's referred to as a junk bond. A junk bond is sometimes sort of said in a pejorative way, who would ever buy a junk bond? Junk bonds are somehow wrong or evil. But, if you just said a junk bond is a high risk bond that promises a high interest rate, and it promises the high interest rate because it's high risk, that's all it is. I mean, there's nothing wrong or evil about it. It's just something with a high risk premium. So one way in which companies borrow money is by issuing bonds. The other way, which is perhaps more familiar to a lot of us, is they also can borrow from banks. Many banks have, or companies have a line of credit with certain banks, and they just are going to borrow from banks when they need to. Most of the time, it seems that established companies borrow from banks only when they've got really sort of a short-term need. If they've got a bigger need, then they go to the credit markets and they issue bonds or something like that for a big investment. A third source of money for firms when they're trying to get capital is stock or equity investment in the firm. Again, I find that some people who are new to the subject of economics are a little intimidated by talking about the idea of what stock is, but it's really not tremendously complicated. At a simple level, stock is just ownership of a company. You can imagine a company, for example, where the ownership is divided up into 100 shares, that is 100 shares of stock. And if you owned 10 out of those 100 shares, then you would own 1/10 of the company. What does owning 1/10 mean? It means that if the company starts handing out profits to its investors, you would get 1/10 of those profits because you own 1/10 of the company. If the company starts having a vote on changing its director or changing its chief executive officer, you get 1/10 of the votes because you own 1/10 of the company. So stock is just ownership in a company. Now, from a company's point of view, the nice thing about stock is that when someone buys stock in your company, you haven't promised to pay them a blessed thing. If your company does well, they benefit. If your company does poorly, they can get zero. If your company goes bankrupt, the stock may literally be worth nothing. So there's no guarantee of being paid anything at all. If you buy bonds from a company and they've promised to pay you, say, 8% interest, and you don't get that 8% interest, you can take that company to court, you can sue them, you can tell them that, you know, if they don't pay, you drive them into bankruptcy and you sell their equipment, you get your money any way you can. But if you buy stock in a company and the company goes broke and doesn't earn any money, you really have no recourse unless you can prove that something terribly fraudulent happened. Basically, you're just out of luck. The flip side, of course, is that although you're not promised anything with stock, stock also has a very large upside. If you buy a company's bonds and they promise to pay 8% interest, well, they just pay the 8% interest. They pay it, and they pay it, and they pay it, and that's pretty much the end of the story. Even if the company does really well, all you get is your 8% interest. On the other hand, if you buy stock in a company and the company does extremely well, the value of the company goes up, the profits of the company keep going up and up, then you have an unlimited amount of money you can make. I mean, sometimes you run into somebody who did something like, you know, bought IBM in 1940 or something like that and just held on to it year after year after year after year. I think the average rate it went up was something like 17 or 18% a year for about 45 years. IBM stock hasn't done so well the last 10 or 12 years, but boy, it was just a gravy train for a long time. Or if you think about somebody more recently who bought stock in Microsoft or Intel back in around 1980 or 1985, boy, they've been doing awfully well off that stock ever since. And so stock has a bigger upside and a bigger downside. It's riskier if you want to think about it in that way. But that's from the point of view of an investor, either good or bad, depending on how much risk you want to take. Now, most companies, established companies, tend to use retained earnings or the bank for everyday financing. They use bonds when they're investing something really big. They don't tend to issue much more stock. Stock tends to be something that you issue when you're a small company and then you sort of trying to just gather up money to make your first big push. Why is that? Why don't established companies like General Motors issue more stock a lot of the time? Well, there are at least two reasons that I think are worth remembering. One reason is that, remember, stock is just ownership in the company. So when you issue more stock, then all the previous owners who used to own 100% of the company now only own 95% of the company, or 90%, or 80%, and the new stock owners own the rest. Now, the old stock owners may not be so happy about this. This is referred to as diluting their interest in the company. And so current stock owners would rather you don't issue more stock. They don't want their share of the company diminished because you're issuing new stock. But more interesting is, I think, this argument. Think about, for a moment, what you would think to yourself if an established company came out on the market and said, we want to offer stock. I suggest that if you think of it through for a little bit, your line of thought would go something like this. Boy, here's this established company. They've got banks. They've got bonds. Why aren't they out there going to their bank and borrowing this money? After all, they should want to go to the bank, or they should want to issue bonds first. Because after all, remember, those pay a fixed interest rate. So if they've got some really good deal lined up, they should borrow the money, pay, you know, 7-8% interest, and then rake in the profits on top of that. So why aren't they doing that? And if you think about it for a little bit, you may begin to have fear. And the fear in your heart would say something like, you know, the reason they're not issuing bonds or they're not going to their bank is their bank said, we're not going to do this. We don't think this is a good idea. Actually, you're on the verge of losing money. And the reason they're trying to issue stock is because they're desperate. Now, of course, you don't know any of that for sure, but you know that if they could, it would be in their own best self-interest to issue bonds or borrow from the bank. And you know they're not doing that. So when people go out and try and issue new stock as a well-established company, investors tend to go, whoa, the only reason you could be doing this is no one else is willing to lend money to you. And if no one else is willing to lend money to you, I am not willing either. I'm not willing to put money into your company. So established companies tend not to issue stock just because it's hard to figure out why it would make sense for a healthy company to do that. What we'll do in the next lecture, then, is return to these different ideas of stocks and bonds and different kinds of investment. But instead of looking at them from the business point of view, we're going to look at them from the consumer's point of view in terms of how people can invest and how you can try and get rich in the stock market. But before doing that, it's worth winding up here with the thought that this idea of investment and encouraging investment is just tremendously, terribly important to the U.S. economy. Investment over time, and I don't just mean investment in plant and equipment, but I mean investment in people, I mean investment in education, I mean investment in a skilled workforce, I mean investment in a clean environment. All of that is just tremendously important to our long-term human happiness and human health. Really, the key to raising our long-term standard of living is to think about those investments that we can make now, which will have large payoffs into the future. So encouraging investment, figuring out how investment can happen, making sure firms have investment capital, making sure the government thinks about certain investments, should not be thought of as some abstraction, something separate and apart. It should be thought about as something which is really central to raising our standard of living over the next few decades.